Hello and welcome to All Indians Matter. I'm Ashraf Engineer. Responding either to the call of their own conscience or influenced by the trend of billionaires abroad giving away large portions of their wealth, the Indian wealthy have also taken to philanthropy in a big way. By its private nature and size, big philanthropy has the power to influence the development agenda of civil society. But how effective this power will be in achieving societal goals depends on how well philanthropists understand ground issues and the interplay of different factors in social change.
All Indians Matter.
On the show is Ingrid Srinath, a passionate advocate for human rights, social justice and civil society for over 20 years. She is the founder director of the Center for Social Impact and Philanthropy, or CSIP, at Ashoka University. Ingrid transitioned from a career in advertising to the non-profit sector in 1998 with CRY, as Child Rights and You is better known, where she was CEO from 2004 to 2008. She then served as Secretary General at Civicus, World Alliance for Citizen Participation, as Executive Director of Childline India Foundation, and as CEO of HeWas India. Ingrid is a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Future Council on Systemic Inequalities and Social Cohesion. She has served on the advisory boards of the United Nations Development Programme, the United Nations Development Cooperation Forum, the World Economic Forum, the Young Lives Project at Oxford University, the Prajna Trust, the Center for African Philanthropy and Social Investment, and Fair Share of Women Leaders. She was also on the boards of the Worldwide Initiative for Grantmaker Support, the INGO Accountability Charter, and Majlis Law. Today, we'll talk about philanthropy in India and the difference it can make. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Thank you for having me, Ashraf, and thank you for choosing to focus on this much needed topic.
You're very welcome. We are very happy to have you on the show. Ingrid, India's economic growth has been matched by growing societal inequality. We are ranked 131 on human development, 102 on hunger, and 112 on gender parity. What can philanthropy do that the government hasn't been able to do?
So ideally, philanthropy plays a role in society which is quite distinct from either business or government. Quite often, governments are constrained by their electoral cycles and their electoral compulsions. Similarly, business by market cycles. And so neither of them is able to make investments that are either long-term or that where the outcomes are less than certain, or that cater to causes that are niche. You know, I mean, the government is looking to reach the majority of the electorate. Business is looking for the biggest sectors of the market that it can influence. It's very likely in those situations that smaller pockets get left out. And so philanthropy's core reason for being is to do the opposite, to provide patient, long-term risk capital, especially to those causes which are likely to be ignored by market and state. The other thing it can do that government and business cannot do is incubate innovations that are not immediately market friendly. So for example, if you think of anything in India from the Jaipur Foot to Narega to microfinance, all of these are initiatives that were originally incubated in civil society before government or business could then take them to scale.
That's an interesting point. But Ingrid, philanthropy is not new to India. I mean, for instance, the Tatas have had it at the core of their DNA forever. And it has been estimated that philanthropic funds in India have grown by over four times between 2010 and 2018. Why has the spread become wider in the past decade or couple of decades?
So the first and most obvious answer is economic prosperity, especially for those individuals who've been well positioned to take advantages of the benefits of liberalization. So those who were the beneficiaries of large-scale privatization, large-scale opening up of markets, have been disproportionately rewarded, let's say, in terms of wealth. The second factor, I think, is peer pressure. So, you know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, the Giving Pledge, this has played a role in changing the norms on how one manages wealth and what is the purpose of wealth. Is it simply to bequeath to one's future generations or to stash away, or is it to make some impact on society? I think that the CSR law, as it's commonly called in India, or the requirement in the Companies Act for companies to do philanthropy, which came in 2014, has also resulted in a big push. We know that there's now about 14,000 crores a year coming in just through that channel. I think media is also playing a role, both traditional media and social media, because it's making us more aware of what's happening in the world. It's bringing causes and issues into our homes and to our desktops. And it's also making it easier to make a difference and to respond. So if I look at, you know, online giving, for example, we're being told that during COVID, online giving in India went up by anywhere between 200 and 500%. And that's really something that is completely unprecedented in India. And finally, there's the efforts of organizations like Daan Utsav, Giving Tuesday, Living My Promise, and even NGOs like Cry, Goonj, that have played this role in promoting the idea of secular philanthropy, because religious philanthropy has existed for thousands of years. It's secular philanthropy, if you will, that is a more recent development.
That's right. And which causes or fields is Indian philanthropy focusing on at the moment? And could you also detail some of the impacts it has had in those fields?
So you will hear me say this again and again. There's virtually no data on how much philanthropy there is in India or where the bulk of philanthropy goes. We know that religious philanthropy is still a very large recipient, or religious institutions are still a very large recipient of giving by Indians. I sometimes joke that in the secular end of the spectrum of giving, education is to Indian philanthropy what cricket is to Indian sport. It just consumes so much of the resources and so much of the bandwidth.
I love the analogy.
It leaves very little for other causes. But luckily, in recent times in particular, I think health, water and sanitation, scientific research, mental health are finally, and livelihoods are finally starting to get more traction in sort of institutional philanthropy. In the middle class and with NRIs and people of Indian origin, it's causes relating to children, to the elderly, and particularly to one's own community that predominate. The impacts are manifold. I mean, as I said, it's from the, you know, when you think about how do we even know how to address a situation of child marriage, for example, or child labor? It's all because somebody funded a Shanta Sena to experiment in Rangareddy district back in the 1980s. And therefore, we now have a handle on how to deal with child labor. Or if you look at some of the more recent work in digitizing education, digitizing land records, RTI, NAREGA. These are all things that somebody, either an institutional philanthropist or communities themselves, felt it was worth investing in, that you then see as having this sweeping national impact. You know, this is not just affecting a few thousand or even hundreds of thousands of people. When you are able to amend the constitution, for example, to make education a fundamental right, that affects every child in India, and it affects, you know, in the country in every way possible. So impact has been huge and manifold, but every bit counts. I mean, if your impact is to change the life of somebody in your immediate neighborhood, person's outlook on life a little better, then that's still impact that counts. Every bit counts.
Absolutely. But what about the areas that have been neglected that you think could do with some philanthropic attention?
Well, unsurprisingly, given our country, I think that causes relating to women and gender, including LGBT causes, are among the least well served. Similarly, again, unsurprisingly, initiatives led by minorities, by Dalits, by members of tribal communities are particularly underfunded. And then in sort of what you might call more emerging issues, the climate crisis, arts and culture, sports, and human rights issues, are the ones that are disproportionately lacking support. We tend mostly to support work that is very tangible, easy to see, easy to measure, easy to photograph. So, you know, children being fed or toilets being built has a very concrete feel to it. But if you go more upstream, work that influences policy or work that pays to strengthen the organizations that deliver those services, that's harder to find.
That's a telling commentary, actually. But is there also a geographical skew in the way giving is done in India?
Oh, absolutely, very much so. So states like Maharashtra, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh attract the bulk of philanthropic attention, especially from CSR, where the guidelines explicitly sort of prefer funding to go to things within the vicinity of your own factories or offices. The states with the greatest need, the northeastern states in particular, but also Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, are relatively neglected.
In fact, when you made the point, I was about to say that these are the more advanced states. So, I mean, it's quite counterintuitive that they get more, while the not as advanced states get much less.
Yeah, we give where we can see, feel, and touch the impact. And that tends to be where the wealthier people are and where the businesses are located.
Yeah, the earlier point that you made about issues regarding women and minorities and things like that, it's also politically sensitive, isn't it? Those sort of issues where people don't really want to get into.
It is, and this is an increasing constraint, if you will. I mean, I think the levels of anxiety about potential repercussions are such that people are almost, the metaphor I use, they're coloring well within the lines. You know, nobody wants to go even close to the lines for fear that they inadvertently cross some line and face some consequences.
I also read a staggering statistic, actually. In 2020, the world globally added 3 billionaires every 2 days, while India added one a week. So do you think India's billionaires, despite everything that you said, are giving away enough?
I mean, I could ask the philosophical question, how much is enough? But the short answer, again, to your question is that we don't know. There's so little publicly available information about private philanthropy in India that it's hard to say. We have now pretty good data on CSR. We have pretty good data on international funding coming to India under the FCRA. We have some information on individual giving by people like you and me through tax exemptions, at least. But we have virtually no information on how the wealthy invest their philanthropy. There's also clearly a very wide spectrum. So you have people like Azim Premji, the Nilekanis, Kiran Majumdar-Shaw, who are signatories to the Giving Pledge, for example, and have publicly committed to give away at least 50% of their wealth, either at their, during their lifetimes or at their deaths. Then you have people like Amit Anarchana Chandra or Anil Naik of L&T, who are giving away not wealth, but 75% of their income, which is a whole other level of giving. And then there are probably some wealthy people among those 209 billionaires who are just barely meeting the 2% CSR requirement. So it's clearly a spread. We definitely need to have much more information. And in a country where poverty is as dire as India, enough is, again, such a hard norm.
Yeah, tough to quantify.
So in countries like the US, they estimate that 2% philanthropy accounts for 2% of GDP or is equivalent to 2% of GDP. We don't have that kind of data here to that even sets the norm. You know, how much should I give as an individual? Do you know how much? What would be a good percentage to give? I mean, among Muslims, for example, you know, zakat in some ways prescribes at least a minimum norm. But for the rest of us, there isn't a clear norm as to what's an appropriate amount to give.
Absolutely. I mean, also the US is far more advanced and far more developed and prosperous than India. So what counts as enough there obviously doesn't count as enough here. That's an important point.
Surprisingly, across countries, the poor give a larger percentage of their income than the wealthy do.
Wow. Has the COVID-19 pandemic actually made philanthropy even more of an imperative, you think? I know the obvious answer is yes, but if you could expand on that.
So I think the pandemic has done two critical things that relate to philanthropy. I think first, it has made starkly visible the scale of the need. You know, and now it's made it impossible to avoid noticing how precariously people around us are living in terms of their lack of housing, healthcare, income support, job security, safety nets, any kind of social protection, really. And the second thing it showed us is what levels of generosity and compassion and urgency, which we are capable of, both individually and collectively. So if you saw big philanthropy like the Premjis and the Tata Foundations, respond to the PM CARES Fund or with PPE to medical institutions and frontline workers, you saw, but you also saw every individual. I can't think of an individual in India who didn't respond either with cash or with food or with transportation or with volunteering for some elderly person in their neighborhood.
That's right.
So I think it's demonstrated the capacity we have to give, and we now need to build on that.
You're right about the individuals, because you know many individuals just helped out, even somebody like people who are domestic staff or people who happen to live in the vicinity. Obviously, none of that is documented or even talked about, and obviously then it's tough to quantify. But the other important point that you touched upon was the CSR law. Now the law makes it mandatory for companies of a certain size to invest in CSR. Simplified way of putting it. But some people like Azim Premji again feel that you can't make philanthropy mandatory, that there should be something that you want to do. What's your view on that?
So I entirely agree with Mr. Premji, not just because I don't think you can legislate what should essentially be a voluntary activity, but I think also making it mandatory incentivizes gaming the system. So now we are in this business of where the stage now where we're trading CSR credits. If I underspend, I can sell my, or if I overspend, I can sell my CSR credits to you because you've underspent.
Really? Is that a thing? Yeah. Just like carbon credits.
That's right. So this is, or saying, can I vaccinate my employees and claim that as CSR? I mean, I think the mandatory nature of it incentivizes that kind of gaming of the system. But the biggest problem I have with it is I think it has absolved the corporate sector of true social responsibility. So we're no longer asking the hard questions on human rights in the supply chain or how you treat your employees or what your environmental footprint is, because you write a check for 2% of net profit once a year and that buys you absolution from everything.
Yeah. What are the challenges before philanthropy in India?
I think the biggest challenge is how do we grow it and how do we make it more effective. But I think we're still at a stage really in India where, all philanthropy is good philanthropy, and philanthropy is a sort of an unalloyed good. So we haven't started to ask harder questions like they have in the West, but those are coming soon, I think. So, asking questions about where is this wealth, how is this wealth being accumulated, and why are we, permitting wealthy people to have such a disproportionate impact on policy? Is it sort of anti-democratic? Can we have better norms on transparency, for example, of where the money comes from, how it's used, what impact it has? I think those are harder questions that will start to happen now that philanthropy is reaching a kind of a critical mass.
Yeah, absolutely right. Actually, some of these questions that you spoke about were raised in the West, like you said, especially during the primaries in the US election, where I think Bernie Sanders, of course, famously said that there should be no billionaires. And,
But don't even get me started on election.
So that's another part, the episode, I think. I'll invite you again for that. But Ingrid, what can philanthropists, Indian philanthropists, do differently today to have more of an impact?
So I want to say sharing information would be a good start, partly because, of course, it will allow for better choice making. It will prevent duplication of effort. It will speed up learning. It will improve effectiveness, all that good stuff. But I think also moving upstream. So investing not just in the short term, easy to measure stuff, but moving towards, supporting advocacy, where you improve the delivery of public services and don't just substitute the delivery of public services, where you strengthen the NGOs who deliver those services in terms of their own capacities, their technology. Investing, I of course have a vested interest in asking people to invest in the nonprofit ecosystem, where we build the knowledge, the networks, the norms that underpin the whole philanthropic sector. But most of all, I think at this juncture, my plea to philanthropy would be to support, to protect our democratic freedoms and our constitutional values. That, I think, would be the most valuable contribution of all right now.
Absolutely. Also, Ingrid, I want to push you a little more on something that you've already spoken about. So I wanted to make the distinction between simply giving away money and ensuring that the money that you give away yields real results, right? Which is something that you also spoke about. Now, one report I read described it as the move from quote-unquote compassion-centric giving to development-centric impact investment. Now, that's jargon, of course, but obviously philanthropy can't be only about cutting a check. So could you expand a little more on that?
So I think of it as a continuum. You know, emotions drive people, people drive change. If I look at, for example, we all start with our direct experience. So, for example, if you have lost a family member to cancer, then you might be moved to support other cancer patients who are seeking treatment. Or the more of that you do, you might may then move on to supporting the building of a hospital. Moving further upstream, you might start to fund research into cancer. You might then want to influence public health policy to ensure that all citizens have access to treatment. I think often of Rippon Kapoor, who was the founder of CRY. Rippon started his philanthropy as a school kid, where he was selling newspapers, old newspapers, to buy milk for children, slum children in his neighborhood. Doing that work exposed him to those children, got him to understand why education was a key input. He then went to providing that basic education, quickly realized, oh, this is not working, we need to involve the parents. Quickly realized that's not enough, we need to involve the government. And so, you know, in the space of 25 years, you go from selling raddi to buy milk to getting the constitution amended to make education a fundamental right. And I think that transition is inevitable for every philanthropist. You, as you do it, and the more engaged you are, that you learn the value of moving upstream, so to speak.
Actually, that story about Rippon and CRY is quite fascinating. And I just want to tell listeners, or recommend to listeners who haven't actually read about that story, to actually look it up. It's really fascinating and quite moving, in fact. Ingrid, what are your favorite examples of philanthropy done well?
So I think there are many, but I think the thing I look for is philanthropy that starts with the basic belief that people know best how to solve their own problems. And then it really accompanies them through that process of discovering, testing, growing, and disseminating those solutions. It also starts by acknowledging the imbalance of power and of assets and of voice. And it values what each person is bringing to the table. So it's based on values like dignity and justice, rather than the kind of client-vendor relationship, which I sadly see becoming more and more prevalent in the sector.
Yeah. So tell us, Ingrid, about the Center for Social Impact and Philanthropy, or CSIP, which you head at Ashoka University. Tell us about the work it does, the impact it's had.
So we have the distinction of being India's first and thus far only academic center studying philanthropy and social impact. And as a consequence, we have a lot of backlog to cover, given that there's been thousands of years of philanthropy and we've only been around for 4 years. So we're really, our early work in some ways is focusing on just building that edifice of data and knowledge about the sector. So research on philanthropic flows, the state of the ecosystem, work with Niti Aayog on the regulatory frameworks that govern the sector. We're working with SEBI on this new social stock exchange. And then besides the research, we offer capacity building programs for nonprofit leaders, which we do in collaboration with Harvard Business School. And then we similarly offer a program to young leaders who are just starting out on their careers through a fellowship called the Mother Teresa Fellowship. And then through our convening activity, one of the biggest things we do is an annual event called the Social Innovation Summit, which helps to showcase and disseminate technological innovation in the sector. Most recently, we focused on the impact of both COVID and the new regulatory changes on nonprofits. So a lot of the last 12 months have been spent on understanding what the impact of these has been, disseminating information on how to cope with both the man-made and the non-man-made disasters that we have inflicted on the sector.
So I'm not going to push you on that. But also, Ingrid, you're coming out with a study called The Philanthropic Flows in India. Tell us about it and how it happened and its broad findings.
So as I said, this is almost our first effort. Like we said, how can you call yourself a center for philanthropy if you can't even answer the question, how much philanthropy is there? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? So this was sort of our basic, you know, almost our ante to be our stakes to be in the game, if you will. And so what it does essentially is, with our data partners, who are How India Lives, we're scraping all the government websites to update information on FCRA, CSR funding, the Niti Aayog's Darpan portal, the income tax data sets, to basically ensure that the sector has the most current data available and the most comprehensive data available to inform both its own decisions as well as policy. So this will release, hopefully, in early April, and I'm really looking forward to it, because it, you know, it answers the questions that brought me to the center in the first place. I feel like 22 years ago when I joined the sector, because I came from marketing, the first question I asked was, how big is the market? And they said, we don't know. And it's, to me, truly appalling that 22 years later, we still don't know.
Yeah, you said it's releasing in mid-April. I just wanted to also tell listeners that this is actually being recorded a little before that. And, you know, the episode itself might come out after the study is released. What impact are you hoping for from the study?
So really more rational decision-making, I think, so that, you know, we don't end up duplicating resources, or we know for sure which are the areas that are uncovered, for example, which are the geographies, which are the thematic areas that are underserved, and therefore we can focus our investments in those directions. But also we can see the trends in terms of how it's changing, what has been the impact of everything from COVID to legislative changes and so on. So we, and therefore, you know, it can better inform both philanthropic decision making as well as policy making.
So that's your first step, like you said. So what's next for CSIP?
We have quite a few interesting projects in the pipeline. There's one, we're doing a second round of our COVID impact study. And so we will have a much bigger representative sample of exactly how has the sector been impacted by COVID. Our worry is, when we did a smaller version of this in July, we found that more than half NGOs had less than 6 months of funding left to function. So we're really keen to know how that what that situation looks like after 6 months, so that NGOs can advocate better with funders for the funds they need. The second study we're working on right now is one on talent in the sector, which is looking at everything from what are the needs for talent across the sector, but also how much the sector pay at different levels. And again, to help funders make that decision on what's an appropriate amount of funding to put behind salary costs, but also for NGOs to be able to know what is a reasonable amount I need to pay to attract the talent I want, and for people who are considering a career in the sector to know, okay, what are the sort of career trajectories that are available in the sector, what are the talent needs of the sector. So that's a pretty big one that we're involved in.
Ingrid, thanks so much for being on the show, and thanks for shedding light on philanthropy, which I think at least could be a game changer for India.
Thank you, Ashraf. I'm delighted to have the platform. All I want to really say to your listeners is, it's been a very rough year for nonprofits in India. They responded in ways that I cannot even begin to describe. 80 to 90% of nonprofits have responded in one form or the other, and many are literally on the brink of survival right now. So this is the year for you to give as much as you can to the causes and the organizations that you care about.
I couldn't agree more, and I urge all listeners to do precisely that.
Thank you all for listening. Please visit allindiansmatter.in, that's allindiansmatter.in, for more columns and audio podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Ashraf Engineer, that's ashrafenginwer, and All Indians Count, that's allindianscount. Search for the All Indians Matter page on Facebook. On Instagram, the handle is All Indians Matter. Email me at editor@allindiansmatter.in. Catch you again soon.